So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Welcome to our series this week on the cardinal virtue, specifically of prudence. Join us all week long for this series of how to make more decisive decisions, to actually make decisions in your life and to make them with great virtue. We're also going to discuss the sign of the cross, why we should make it more often, why it used to be a part of the liturgy and a part of the early church's tradition in a way that we've lost today. Joining me now is Reggie Littlejohn. Reggie Littlejohn is the founder and president of Women's Rights Without Frontiers. It's an international coalition that exposes and opposes forced abortion, gendercide, and sexual slavery in China. Reggie has briefed officials at the White House, the United States Department of State, as well as the United Nations and the Vatican. She is a practicing Catholic, and I've not shared this before, and I don't know if Reggie remembers, but some years ago, I think when I was in high school doing pro-life work, I have always admired her work in China, especially against the one child, now three child policy. And so I had written, and she was so kind in the midst of everything that she was doing, writing back to me via email. And so I've always admired her work and her bold voice in the face of incredibly challenging circumstances in China. Yet her organization is one of the few who has people on the grounds to help save babies' lives and the lives of women and the fathers in the face of a radical and forced abortion policy that China implements. Welcome to Trending, Reggie.
Thank you so much, Timory. It's an honor to be here.
Let's dive into a little bit of your work in China. One of the things that I think is extremely beneficial about this conversation, if you're just joining us, is that what's happening in China has actually received bipartisan criticism from both sides of political parties and even from both sides of the pro-life and pro-abortion movement. So if you know someone who's pro-abortion, these atrocities occurring in China and the hope-filled stories of Women's Rights Without Frontiers is a means for having conversation, building bridges with those people who might disagree with you on abortion. Reggie, can you share with us a little bit about the now three-child policy and the work you're doing to save lives there in China?
Well, yes, thank you, Timory. So people think that because China has moved from a one-child policy to a two-child policy and to a three-child policy, what that means is that coercive population control has ended in China. And that is not true, unfortunately, on a couple of fronts. You mentioned bipartisan support. There is bipartisan support, you know, across the spectrum of people on their different positions on the life issue, bipartisan support against what the Chinese Communist Party is doing to the Uyghurs in Xinjiang, which is they've been officially declared by Secretary of State Pompeo and new Secretary of State Blinken, officially declared to be committing genocide. And one of the major ways that they are currently committing genocide is through forced abortion, forced sterilization, and infanticide. And that has been condemned by everyone. There's no one who is supporting that.
And that's regardless of whether or not you've had one child, two child, three children. That is absolute intentional genocide occurring for the Uyghur people.
Well, this is the situation. Yes, they are intentionally trying to basically break the backs of the Uyghur people, and they've been using the two-child policy as an excuse. So, under the two-child policy, every couple is allowed to have two children, so they have been putting in internment camps people who have had three or more children, saying that they had too many children and taking their children away. So when China shifted to a three-child policy earlier this year, I called upon the Chinese government to release every parent that was being interned in basically a concentration camp in Xinjiang and restore their children to them. And of course, we've heard nothing about that. They're not going to do that. But that's the excuse that they use to put these people in internment camps. So now that we have a three-child policy, it was basically announced to the world in such a way that people believe that that forced abortion is not happening anymore. As I just mentioned, it is still happening in Xinjiang to the Uyghurs. But number two, the new rule is every couple is allowed to have three children. So, of course, fourth children are still subject to forced abortion, and I was a fourth child of my parents. So under the three-child policy, I would have been forcibly aborted. And then beyond that, you have to be part of a couple to have a baby. So people who are not part of a couple, in other words, unmarried women, single moms, are still subject to forced abortion under the three-child policy. And in August, I think it was, of 2020, Radio Free Asia came out with a report that mentioned the fact that, according to an official Chinese news outlet, China routinely forcibly aborts, or they don't admit that it's forcible, but they routinely abort 8 million, quote-unquote, extra pregnancies a year in China. What's an extra pregnancy? That's a pregnancy that is without permission, an illegal pregnancy. That, under the two-child policy, would have been unmarried women and third children. And I believe that the vast majority of those 8 million abortions were unmarried women, and that's going to continue under the three-child policy.
Can you speak to the imbalance that forced abortion, gendercide, has done there in China, especially surrounding the fact that the population has been imbalanced now with too many, we won't even say too many men, but more so too little women to marry the men there in China?
Well, sure. So under the one-child policy, people figured if they can only have one kid, they would rather have it be a boy. Then in the two-child policy, which is most of our work has been done under the two-child policy, the work saving baby girls has been done since the two-child policy. What demographers have found is that couples are willing to, if the first child is a girl, they're willing to let her live, thinking, okay, we can have a boy on the second child. And so then women are forced, not by the government, but by their own families, their husbands and their mother-in-law, typically, to abort or abandon a second daughter. And then my concern with the three-child policy is that most couples in China don't even want to have a second child, much less a third child, because it's so expensive in China, and because they've been brainwashed and browbeaten into thinking that one child is the best. Right. So my concern is that under the three-child policy, that the only couples that are going to be willing to go to the effort and expense of having a third child are those who have two girls. And I believe that the vast majority of the babies born, that third child, are going to be boys.
Let's discuss a little bit more of what happens if someone was, let's say, born illegally. Because as you've laid out, now currently there's a three-child policy. But if you're unmarried or if you have more than three children, that child is not approved of by the government. So what happens when these children unfortunately, the rare instances actually do make it to term, are born. What is their legal status in society there in China?
So it depends on where in China the child is born. So there's, China's a big country, and their authorities, the central government is not, it's not as powerful there as it is here. Like here, if the Supreme Court does something, then it's implemented uniformly across the land. It's not true in China. So an illegal baby, can you imagine that a person's existence is illegal? I mean, it's something we can't even think about. So it's an illegal pregnancy in China. Two things can happen. One is the person can be forcibly aborted. One thing is they can be offered a fine, but the fine is so steep. It could be up to 10 times a person's annual income. Mm-hmm. That most people can't afford to pay it, and so then they are forcibly aborted, but then the officials say, well, she chose to have that abortion because she chose not to pay the fine. Actually, she just couldn't pay the fine. Mm-hmm. So if the baby is born, they can be hidden. So there's a whole population of hidden babies in China, or hidden people in China, that they have no official status, they don't have a birth certificate, they can't officially work, they can't officially marry, they can't officially travel because they were just hidden by their parents. And so there's really a two-tiered society of the people who are legally born and have hukou, household registration, and then people who are not. But that's the only alternative for some of these illegal babies or these illegal people, because if your parents can't afford to pay the what they call a social compensation fee, you can't get a birth certificate. You can't be legal. You're an illegal person in your own country for your entire life.
If you're just joining us, that's Reggie Littlejohn. Her organization is Women's Rights Without Frontiers. We'll post a link to that on our show notes at relevantradio.com/trending. But again, that's womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. Now, Reggie, you have people on the ground listening, watching, so that people here from America can offer resources to help save babies and families there in China. Can you share with us some of the good news of how you've been able to intervene and save the lives of babies?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah, we are actually the only organization in the world with boots on the ground inside of China, actively saving baby girls and also abandoned widows. And the reason that we're the only organization is because it's extremely dangerous work. Okay, so the Chinese government doesn't like people. These are local people. It's not like I go over to China and help the babies. These are local people who are helping them, who are extremely brave. And what we do is, I mean, I'll just give an example. Best way to explain this is just by an example. So a number of years ago, there was a woman who was pregnant, and her mother-in-law was pressuring her to have an ultrasound to see whether she's carrying a boy or a girl. And she resisted because she knew what that ultrasound meant, that if it was a boy, she could keep the baby, and if it was a girl, she would be pressured to abort the baby, and she didn't want to abort her baby, so she dragged her feet until she was well along into her third trimester, finally went in to get the ultrasound, and discovered that not only was she carrying one, but she was carrying two baby girls, twin girls. So what would be a cause for immense joy and celebration in the United States was catastrophic for her, because her mother-in-law started pounding her, not physically, but verbally and emotionally, to terminate that pregnancy, because even under the two-child policy, she would use up her entire quota of children, and they would both be girls, and she didn't want to, and she was desperate, and she didn't know what to do. So thank God, our field worker heard about her, went to her door and said, "Congratulations on your twin daughters. Girls are as good as boys. And we will offer you 2 monthly stipends for a year to empower you to keep those daughters." So, because what we do is we offer them $25 a month in the local currency, in the Chinese currency, to empower them to keep their daughters. And so she was able to go to her husband and to her mother-in-law and say, "Look, I can't afford, I can't abandon these baby girls. They're lucky girls. Look, they're already bringing money into the family." And we have saved about 300 baby girls in China with this method.
Wow, Reggie, that's incredible. You know, we so often here in the United States, we'll talk about how new life is a gift. With every child, you know, comes a loaf of bread underneath the arm. But sometimes that requires someone else being willing to help. And I even think, you know, the blessings in my own life with having our baby girl and how generous everyone was in supporting, you know, our first baby in the family. And this is what you are doing in China, in a culture that has radically become pro-abortion because of forced abortion. It has become pro-gendercide, where they're keeping one type of baby over the other. And what is the equivalent of 25 Chinese dollars to American dollars?
It's about 160 yuan. So that's sizable money in the Chinese countryside. You know, these families are so poor. Wow. And my the lead field worker once broke it down for me, like how many eggs, how many, you know, bushels of wheat, how many baskets of vegetables would have to be sold by the parents in order for them to have a net profit of $25. And it's just backbreaking to think of it. So this is a real incentive to them. By American standards, it's like give up one Starbucks a week and that's what you have, just about, maybe two Starbucks a week, and you can help save a life.
Wow, that's incredible. It's amazing the capacity for our generosity to actually help people. So we are praying for you and the work that you're doing, for your field workers to be able to reach these people before abortions are forcefully occurring or pressured into happening. And so again, if you would like to support Women's Rights Without Frontiers and the work that you're doing on the ground there in China, as Reggie mentioned, they are the only organization on the ground helping women to keep their babies, fighting against gendercide and outright genocide occurring there in China. Check them out at womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. I'll post a link on social media. We're going to come back with Reggie Littlejohn and we'll discuss some of the challenges there surrounding human rights violation and their currency surrounding social currency, surrounding surveillance state that China implements with anything from practicing your faith, posting on social media, to how many children you have. Don't go away. We'll also come back continuing our series on the cardinal virtue of prudence. And also today, why do we make the sign of the cross and why should we make it more often?
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
We're going to dive into the topic of why we make the sign of the cross over the bodies. Is this rooted in Scripture? Did you know it's actually in the Old Testament as well? Did you know that the early church made the sign of the cross repeatedly, over and over again, and they're coming, they're going before bed, before a meal, before standing up, sitting down, laying down. Why did they do that, and why have we lost this? We're also going to continue our series on the cardinal virtue of prudence, making decisive decisions, taking action in our lives, but in the right way. Joining me now is Reggie Littlejohn. She's been sharing about the life-saving work of her organization, Women's Rights Without Frontiers. She is the founder and president of this organization that works as an international coalition exposing everything from forced abortion, gendercide, and sexual slavery in China. Now, China, you may have followed what has been happening with their now social credit system and a surveillance state that has been implemented in China. I had known this was happening, but I remember a couple years ago, I met a young woman about 20 years old who was adopted from China, as was her younger sister. Her sister was adopted when she was about 11 or 12 years old, and she had been with her adoptive family since she was about 8. And she shared how scared her little adopted sister was over the use of social media in the United States, because in China, the use of social media is often banned, or when various opinions are shared contrary to the Chinese Communist Party, there's a punishment for the family, financially, politically, morally, even just the capacity to go about living your life day to day. And so joining me now to discuss this surveillance state in China and the social credit system is Reggie Littlejohn. Can you share with us a little bit of what's happening with the social credit system and how it impacts people from the day to day?
Well, Timory, the social credit system is something that is relatively new. It's just been rolled out in the last couple of years. And what it has to do with is it is putting everything about a person digitally into one centralized place so that they can come up with a score of you as a person. So what they centralize is they have facial recognition, they have real-time geolocation, meaning they know where you are physically because of your phone, right? They track also your social media posts, as you mentioned, your internet search history, because there are things in China that you're not allowed to search for. You're not allowed to search, for example, like what happened on Tiananmen Square or issues concerning Taiwan or Tibet or Hong Kong. Any of those searches will get you in trouble in China. So then also your online purchase history, okay, anything you bought, your credit card, your bank account, your criminal history, your medical history. So they put all this together in one centralized database, and they come up with a number. And that number represents whether you are a reliable citizen. So if you have a high social credit score, you can lead what looks like a normal life, except you're a slave. Because if you step out of line in any way, like if you search for Tibet or anything like that, they have these internet police that will actually show up at your door. And who knows what will happen to you? People have been detained because of their internet searches. Okay, so if you have a high score, like you always do, you never take issue with the government. You completely agree with the government's narrative. You're a strong supporter of the Chinese Communist Party. You can lead what looks like a normal life. If you start departing from that, like you start searching for things that you're not supposed to search for, or you buy a book that you're not supposed to buy, of course, they probably wouldn't even be available in China. But if you post something critical of the government, your social credit score can go down. So then what happens? People who have a low credit score, they're not allowed to officially travel. They can't borrow money, so they can't buy a home. They can't have a mortgage. Their kids will not go into the school, a good school. They can lose their job if your score goes even lower than that, because all of these things are attached to your bank account and your credit cards. And because they have a cashless society, they can turn off your credit cards. They can cut you off from your bank account, so you can't buy food. And if it goes even lower than that, like if you are a true dissident and are really trying to expose and oppose the atrocities of the Chinese Communist Party, you can be disappeared very quickly because of the real-time geolocation and the facial recognition. They know exactly where everybody is in China. So that's the kind of surveillance state that that China is, and that's why your friend's younger sister was so terrified when she saw people posting, because the kinds of things that's the kind of thing that can get you in a lot of trouble in China.
And for a 12-year-old to have that level of fear and knowledge and understanding, it's scary. And at the same time, people will start to compare this even to what's happening in the United States surrounding, for example, social media posts. Tons of people, if you don't follow a particular narrative about COVID, if you disagree, people's social media accounts aren't just being, posts being taken down, but they're being deleted and blocked from utilizing everything from YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook. But let's look at this with regard to something else. Can you comment on the concern you have regarding possible digital vaccine passport technology on cell phones and its similarity to what you've seen occur firsthand with China's social credit system?
Yes, this is so important, Timmarie. So I have an I started an initiative together with another organization. It's called StopVaxPassports.org. And you can look it up. And the reason I did this was because of exactly what you said. According to tech experts, and the main one I'm relying on, his name is Jay Valentine, and he was the one who designed the fraud detection software for eBay. So he's a serious tech expert. According to tech experts, the digital vaccine passport utilizes a platform that could incorporate all the functionality of the China social credit system. So I just want to be clear. I'm not an anti-vaxxer. I've traveled around the world. I've been vaccinated for just about everything you can think of. And so I'm not talking about the vaccine. And I'm not even talking about the paper vaccine, like if you have a certificate that's a piece of paper that says I've been vaccinated. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a digital vaccine passport that is on your phone. According to Jay Valentine, according to somebody else named Naomi Wolf, all the functionality of the China social credit system can be attached to that digital passport, and it could be an open door to mass surveillance and even totalitarianism wherever it is implemented, including in the United States.
Wow. And this is a lot to look at. I know many people are concerned about freedoms violations from everything from being forced to have a vaccine. In fact, California last night is trying to push through and gut current bills to force vaccinations for employees, as well as anyone who wants to shop in public places in California. But this is that is a huge problem. But as is this, focusing on the fact that the technologies in a potential digital vaccine passport is similar to the same infrastructure of the Chinese social credit system. You know, we know that we have everything from facial recognitions on iPhones to fingerprinting to geolocation on iPhones. In fact, you know, many people have seen firsthand that they have received pings on their phone from the government in local areas, letting them know, oh, you've been in close proximity to someone else who's had a vaccine. Part of the reason they've been able to do that is because of geomapping, geolocation. So, do you find that this is disheartening and concerning from an American perspective? You know, some people might say this is a slippery slope, but others might say, well, we're not that far off.
Okay. This is not a slippery slope. This is jumping off the cliff. So as you said, and as Jay Valentine says, all of these different things are already being surveilled, okay? So your internet search history is already captured. Your internet purchasing history is captured. Your social media posts are captured. All these things are captured, all right? The difference between China and the United States is in China, it's in a centralized, mandatory database. And in the United States, one area of what you do is not available to another area of what you do. So like if you go to the store and you buy coffee, for example, with a credit card at any store, that store, it's attached to your name that you bought this certain brand of coffee. So when you check out, you will get a coupon for a competing brand of coffee. Fine, whatever. Right. We know that they're tracking our purchases in the grocery store, but that's not connected to your credit card or your bank account. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
Your social media posts. Our social media posts are not connected to our credit cards and our bank accounts and our geolocation. So that's what the vaccine passport does, because it's digital and because it's mandatory, that it provides the same platform or similar platform, a platform in which all this functionality could be attached in a matter of hours, not days, weeks, months, hours. And that's why this is jumping off the cliff. This is not like, okay, so they're surveilling something else. They're surveilling our vaccine status. Who cares? It's just one more thing. No, it is something where all of this stuff could be centralized. And so once that happens, and this is what Naomi Wolf really hammers on, once that happens, it will be very difficult to dissent anymore. Because if you post something online that is a dissenting voice against the dominant narrative, whatever that is, That's attached to your credit card. It's attached to your bank account. It's attached to your geolocation. It's attached to your facial recognition. That's very frightening. We need to resist these passports.
That's Reggie Littlejohn here on Trending with Tim Ray. So what are you encouraging people to do, Reggie? Because, again, you said this isn't a slippery slope. The technology is there. It's just like what is already had with a communist Chinese party, with a surveillance state. What are people supposed to do?
Okay, so first of all, I would encourage, this is a national broadcast. Wherever you are, like whatever state you're in, look for people who are doing something and join them, okay? So I know that there's people who are doing things in New York, in California. Today is a national truckers strike. And truckers are against these passports, and they are and mandates, and they're like not delivering their goods for one day. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of creative things to do. But also, please go on our new website. It's called StopVaxPassports.org, and that's StopVaxPassports.org, and sign the petition. We've got about 4,300 signatures right now. I'd like to have 43,000 or 430,000. Signatures, because the more signatures we have, the more clout we have to do things like we recently sent a letter to President Biden and Vice President Harris saying you got to stop these passports. We also just are right now, like this week, we are in the process of sending letters to every Republican senator and every Republican member of the House saying you've got to enact legislation to stop these things. Please sign the petition, and that enables us to say we've got this large number of people who agree with us, and you've got to listen to us.
To reiterate what you're saying, Reggie, it's important that people understand this has nothing to do with whether or not to get the vaccine. It has to do with technologies potentially being implemented for a digital vaccine passport. These technologies that are very similar to the Chinese surveillance state and social credit system that you've seen firsthand with your work with Women's Rights Without Frontiers in China. So I want to encourage people to just check out, learn more about this, stop. VaxPassports.org. We're just talking about, again, digital passports that could lead to a social credit system like is currently implemented in China. Reggie, thank you so much for joining us. I want to encourage you to follow her work, support what they're doing there on the grounds in China to save babies, especially baby girls. Check them out at womensrightswithoutfrontiers.org. I'll post a link to that on social media as well as in the show notes for today's show at relevantradio.com/trending. I'll be right back to discuss and continue our series on prudence, a cardinal virtue, as well as why we make the sign of the cross and why we should do it more often. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
We're talking about what you're thinking about. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Have you ever pondered the purpose for making the sign of the cross? We'll discuss that in just a little bit, how it's rooted in sacred scripture, even the Old Testament, and why we should make it more often. Let's discuss now our cardinal virtue that we have been pondering this week in our series on prudence. Yesterday, I dove into a deeper understanding to help us understand the importance of this great virtue, especially understanding that prudence is developing a natural sense of what to seek and what to avoid. This is important, as I mentioned, because we live in a trend in society of indecisiveness. The capacity to make decisions has dwindled, and the capacity to make good decisions has dwindled. Often, people like to leave their options open, whether it has to do with who they marry, who they date, what commitments they make on Friday night, because they want to keep the possibilities open. In the end, it leads many people to making no choices, even failing to make good choices. So prudence is a cardinal virtue. Well, what's a cardinal virtue? Well, a cardinal virtue has to do, as the tradition has held and discussed, with helping us to understand that these are the most important virtues. They are the principle among all virtues, and especially the virtue of prudence. In fact, St. Thomas Aquinas discusses how prudence helps all the other virtues. It helps in directing the virtues. Prudence itself resides in the intellect. It's an intellectual decision. And prudence, being a cardinal virtue, has to do with helping us understand as a cardinal virtue that it's a door hinge to all the other virtues. I remember seeing some years ago an icon of a door. And on it had four words, prudence. And then the other three cardinal virtues of justice, fortitude, and temperance. And then it listed other virtues as well that are very important, but it showed how prudence, followed by justice, fortitude, and temperance are the most important. And the reason we talk about them as the cardinal virtues or the door hinge virtues is because these virtues are what all of the other virtues hinge upon. You have the hinge on a door holding up the door. This is how we open and close it. If the door hinge isn't functioning properly, well, then the door isn't functioning properly. We might not even be able to walk through. We might make a loud noise, for example, which occurs right now in my house, and wake up the baby if you open the door. You might scrape the wall. You might even break the door. This is why having those hinges strong are so important. And specifically, prudence holds a primary place among the four cardinal virtues, above all the other virtues. of course, setting the theological virtues aside that are on a totally different level because they're the three theological virtues. You see, let's dive in a little further into this virtue of prudence. St. Thomas Aquinas discusses, and we were talking about this yesterday, the importance of making decisions. He talks about how the prudent man considers things afar off. That is, he has foresight. I'll go on, he says, in so far as they tend to be a help or a hindrance to that which has to be done at the present time. So a person who is prudent has foresight as they consider things. And this helps them in either a good way, helping them along their decision, the functioning of their life, or it becomes a hindrance based on the decision they make at a given moment. That's why we discussed yesterday why you have to have context, perspective, good intentions, and be reasonable, and even have a process of comparison when making a prudential decision. Aristotle, the great philosopher, says a prudent man takes a good counsel. Let's talk about this. Because what does it mean to take good counsel? Who do you consult with to make your decisions? Taking good counsel is something that many of us need to ponder more often. Do I seek a counsel by praying? Do I seek counsel, which, by the way, counsel is one of the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit? Do I read to inform myself, to inform my conscience, to inform my decision-making before making a prudential decision for myself, the life of my family, and others? Do I consult important people, family members, those people who have had experience in a particular decision, wise people I know? See, counsel is part of what's at the heart as well of a prudential decision. Aristotle's also said that prudence is right reason applied to action. But are we taking the moment and the time to ponder, think through, work through, anticipate the future, and make a decision? No decision will be absolutely perfect per se. Sure, we can make a good decision and difficult circumstances could still come from it. But we are challenged to make prudential decisions that bring about the best possible outcome. Again, we talked yesterday about good decisions leading to good ends, good goals. Thomas Aquinas discusses how prudence is oriented toward wisdom about human affairs, about human goods, that it moves, in a sense, the human person not just toward common sense, but prudence when it comes to the human person, wisdom surrounding man. Now, wisdom properly has to do with the things of God, the highest things. But prudence is a form of wisdom when it comes to man. So we need to ask ourselves questions as we talk about making prudential decisions. And I want to walk through these questions because I think this is important homework for us in order to grow in our virtuous life, to grow in our character, to form our character, to make better decisions, and to start making decisions. As I said before, there's a trend in the culture to not make decisions, to just wait for things to hit a point of absolute implosion, or where you're forced into making a decision and your options have now become limited. Maybe it's because we want limited options, because we don't think through those choices that we don't want to make. So here are some things for us to ponder. And I want you to really work through this. Do I care to make an informed decision? Or do I just wait for things to hit a crisis mode? Or do I wait until my options are so limited that it becomes easier? Now, there's nothing wrong with waiting things out. But that is also, in and of itself, a prudential decision to wait things out. That is making a decision. Also, do I prepare in advance for what to expect, to anticipate certain decisions that might need to be made? For example, let's say I want to buy a house. I need to make prudential decisions now about my spending habits. How many times I eat out. How many quick Amazon orders I make, even for simple things in my house. Am I preparing in advance for future decisions and future outcomes? My third question that I want to encourage you to ponder is, do I seek counsel? Again, I listened earlier. Virtue of prudence really rests on us taking counsel and making decisions and understanding things. Now that counsel can and should start first and foremost with prayer. Now, don't, I beg you, become that person where you might ask someone, and I think this is a problem for people of faith. People will, maybe I ask you to do something, to volunteer in a particular project, and someone will say, I'll pray about it. Praying about it is important. Very important. You should say, I'll pray about it. But sometimes people use prayer as a crutch. They'll say, oh, I'll pray about it. And they use that as their excuse to not say yes, to not say no, and to not make a decision. They say, I'll pray about it because they don't want to necessarily think about it. Now, I'm all about abandoning our decisions, our desires, our needs, our choices to God. But as we're praying and abandoning these things to God, we also need to make an intellectual decision along the way. That our intellectual decisions are informed and formed by prayer. Now, also remember that one of the seven gifts of the Holy Spirit is counsel. So who should our predominant counselor be when making a decision? Should be the Holy Spirit. It should be prayer. But sometimes our prayer and our good counsel is informed by understanding of the church's teaching. Sometimes this gift of counsel could be informed by spending time with wise individuals, people of faith. Reading is another, and education is another important means of making prudential decisions, a faith-filled, philosophical, and intellectual decision. People are also important at times for making decisions. Our family members, our spouses, our relatives, those who have experience in particular situations, wise people we know. You know, there seems to be a trend where we go to make a decision and we inform our decision quickly with some social media influencer that we love. Well, so-and-so did this, I'll try it too. Well, that particular influencer you follow on social media might have any number of different life circumstances that you and I know nothing about. We're only seeing the facade of the character that is presented on social media. While their decision might be well-informed for them and well-chosen, just following what other people we admire do isn't necessarily the right path to take. Let's ponder for just a moment someone who practiced the virtue of prudence very well. It's the Blessed Virgin Mary. Why do I say this? Because Our Lady we saw as a model in sacred scripture. Two instances off the top of my head that I can think of. One is the presentation in the temple when Simeon makes a prophecy about Jesus Christ and the suffering Our Lady will endure. And what does she do? She ponders these things in her heart. Again, Jesus Christ is lost in the temple, and for 3 days Joseph and Mary are searching for him. She finds Jesus and she asks Jesus, why have you troubled your father and I so? And Jesus says he was in his father's house. He's doing his father's work. And Our Lady yet again pondered these things in her heart. She took the counsel of Christ. She made a decision on what steps to take next. Even if her next steps weren't immediate, she was directing herself through a prayer-filled intellectual pondering. So two more questions to ask ourselves as we talk about prudence today. Do I think about my choices and the execution of the decisions I've made? And the last thing to leave you with, at the end of the day, when you make that examination of conscience, which we should do every day, thinking about the good we've done, how we've grown, and some of our challenges and virtue, but also pondering the challenges, the bad habits, and the outright sins that we commit. As we examine our conscience, ponder, am I making prudential decisions? Am I prudentially working through these difficult circumstances that I know are temptations for me? That I know I've sinned with? This is how we will grow in the cardinal virtue of prudence. Thanks for joining us in our series on prudence. We'll continue this all week long. If you missed yesterday's show, kicking off our series on prudence, head over to relevantradio.com/trending, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen on demand, and share this episode. I now want to dive in to why we should make the sign of the cross more often. So I think I've shared before that I regularly attend the extraordinary form of the Mass, the Latin Mass, on Sundays. And I've also been exposed to many other liturgies, two in particular that I frequented quite often. My husband's a Maronite Catholic, which is the Lebanese rite of the Catholic Church. And something I've noticed with everything from the Maronite rite of Catholicism to the extraordinary form of the Latin Mass to also the Chaldean Catholic rite of Catholicism. All three of them, and I've attended them many times, participated in the liturgy, received the Eucharist, make the sign of the cross far more often than we are accustomed to in our modern liturgy, but also in our day-to-day lives. The sign of the cross is more often a daily, and not just daily, but even minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour, part of the Christian life. And so I want to discuss why we should make the sign of the cross more often. In fact, all the time. And maybe the only time you make the sign of the cross is when you walk into a church on Sunday, dip your fingers in the holy water font, receive the opening blessing from the priest, receive the closing blessing, and then on your way out, you make the sign of the cross again. And the next time you make it is a week away from then. Or maybe you also do pray throughout the week and you make the sign of the cross when you begin and end your prayer. And hopefully when you begin and end your prayer before meals. That's a start. But Jesus Christ has encouraged us to, one, pray without ceasing. And two, Jesus Christ has also encouraged us to pick up our cross and follow him. One way we can pick up our cross and follow him is by literally making the sign of the cross over our bodies time and time again. Let's talk about some of the biblical roots of the cross, because making the sign of the cross on our bodies is an important reminder to unite our suffering, our challenges, our joys, our works to Jesus Christ and his cross. Reminding ourselves to be humble and not to think that it's just me, myself, and I alone doing the good work that I do or suffering and working through the challenges I experience. The great theologian Tertullian, who lived around the year of AD 160 to 225, actually writes about how the early Christian church crossed themselves time and time again. In fact, he said, in all our travels and movements, in all of our coming in and going out, and putting on our shoes, at the bath, at the table, in lighting our candles, in lying down, in sitting down, whatever employment occupies us, we mark our foreheads with the sign of the cross. That's St. Tertullian, an early member of the Catholic Church, an early church Christian. Do we make the sign of the cross when we lie down, when we light candles, when we turn on the lights? That would be the equivalent of lighting candles today. Do we make the sign of the cross when we put on our shoes? Ponder, even after each shoe that we put on. You see, this actually has a great roots in the Old Testament. In fact, the prophet Ezekiel speaks of a vision he has in Ezekiel chapters 8 and 9 in the Old Testament, where Jerusalem's committing all these infidelities, wickedness. They're failing to worship God, and they're actually worshiping the sun. That is, their elders, those people who should be leading the community. And we read in Ezekiel chapter 9 that God's mark is encouraged to be put upon the bodies, the heads of the faithful. A mark that was traced as the Hebrew letter Tav, which is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, which, by the way, means truth. Now, this letter, last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is depicted either as an X or like a T. Now, in Ezekiel chapter 9, God says in this vision, touch no one upon whom is the mark. This is the mark, which resembles the crucifix, Jesus' cross. In the book of Revelation, written by John, the last book of sacred scripture, we know that the saints, those who have already traversed the earth, have been made worthy of the kingdom of heaven, have lived a life in Christ, a sacramental life, the saints are marked with a seal on their foreheads. That same seal, that same mark. Now today, we as Christians can be marked with this same symbol. A symbol of our salvation, a symbol of protection from Christ, a desire to be set apart, to wear and bear the cross of Christ, to be preserved from corruption, and to make a bold and loving commitment to Christ and his cross, to be courageous in marking ourselves even publicly with the cross, to be strengthened by the cross, and to participate in the battle for our soul and the souls of others. We should make the sign of the cross over and over again throughout our day, as the early church has said and pondered over and over again, from Tertullian to St. John Chrysostom, who said this is a staff, a weapon, an impregnable fortress, that is, making the cross over our bodies. He says neither man nor demon will dare to attack you.